justice meant the same thing. But I'm not sure of that anymore. She studied him for a time. He looked like an everyday cowboy who lived from one day to the next, accepting and dealing with the vagaries of life without giving them much thought. Not so Thatcher Hutton. Perhaps he thought too much, saw too much. "Who are you?" she asked in a hushed tone that conveyed her mystification. "Who are you, really? Where did you come from?" He stopped rocking and looked over at her. "What do you mean?" She didn't say anything, only continued to search his face. Finally, he said, "I'm nobody."
"Parents?"
He went back to rocking, but rested his head on the cushion again and gazed into near space. "Well, I didn't hatch, but I don't remember either of them. I was told my father worked in a smithy, shoeing horses mostly. He was accused of laming a horse on purpose because he held a grudge against the owner. The horse had to be put down. My dad was tried and sentenced. He didn't survive prison. I never knew what exactly he died of."
"Is your mother still living?"
"I don't know. She ran off with my daddy's accuser days after he was convicted. They were never seen or heard of again." He glanced over at her and asked dryly, "Do you reckon that story about the lame horse might have been made up?" Laurel was dismayed.
"She just left you?"
"Appears so."
"Who took care of you?"
"I was placed with a family, decent people. They took in orphans, kids like me. We were expected to do chores on their place, but they saw that we got schooling. When I was 11 thereabouts, I heard that a Mr. Henry Hobson, who had a large spread, was looking for hands to drive his sizable herd to the nearest railhead, which at that time was Fort Worth. Mr. Hobson's age requirement for trail hands was 13, but I passed for that. He signed me on." He smiled with one corner of his mouth. "Years later, he told me he knew I'd fudged on my age, but he saw how bad I wanted the job. Anyhow, after the drive, he made it permanent. I lived and worked on his ranch for the next 15 years, till I was drafted into the army."
"Why haven't you gone back?"
"Nothing to go back to." He told her the circumstances, his gaze pensive and sad when he talked about his mentor's death and the change of fortune it had wrought for him. "Mr. Hobson was the finest man I've ever met. I called his son up in Dallas and left word how to reach me. Haven't heard from him, though, and I don't expect to. Don't see that it makes much difference. Not now."
"Now?"
He broke his distant stare and turned to her. "Things have changed, Laurel."
"What things? Since when?"
"Since tonight." He left the rocker and made a circuit of the bedroom. Pausing at one of the windows, he drew the curtain aside and looked out before resuming his restless prowling. Ordinarily, she would have resented his prying and this invasion of her personal space and would have told him so. However, being unsure of his reason for coming here and made timid by his broodiness, she held her tongue. He said, "Before they took Tup away, I had a chance to talk to him. He told me what he remembered about the two people working those stills. One trait he recalled was that they were both light-footed." Now standing in front of her dresser, he looked down at the barrette he'd set there. "Where's Corinne?" Believing it would benefit her to stick as close to the truth as possible, she said,
"She's staying at the shack."
He turned and fixed his gaze on her.
"She was afraid if she didn't pull her weight, I'd kick her out, although I had assured her I wouldn't. But she was doing too much and not giving her broken arm time to heal properly. I took her out there to stay for a while."
"We drove past the old place tonight, twice. The shack was pitch black dark both times."
"I guess she had turned in."
He came toward where she sat on the end of her bed. "If I went back out there right now, would she be there?"
"Why are you asking me all these questions?"
He captured her head between his hands, tilted it back, and brought his face close to hers. "Because I'm afraid we're going to wind up on opposite sides of a bitter and bloody fight."
"What fight?" You know damn good and well what fight, Laurel. Why did I find your hair clip at the sight of a steel? She tried to look down, but he held her head, disallowing her to look away and making it impossible for her to lie to him anymore. With a catch in her voice, she implored him.
Please don't ask.
He stamped a hard kiss on her lips. Please don't answer. He placed his knee on the bed and took her down with him as he stretched out across it. He dug his fingers into her hair as his thumbs brushed across her cheeks. Looking into her eyes, he said,
You knew this was coming, didn't you?
Understanding what he meant by this, she whispered roughly,
Since that day we met on the street.
I knew, sooner than that. Also knew it was a bad idea. You're the damnedest, most complicated woman I've ever met. But I can't stop wanting you.
He kissed her again. This time it started out tender, but almost at once turned tempestuous. When she responded with the same degree of ardor, he placed one arm around her shoulders while the other encircled her waist. She folded her arm around his neck and clung. Moaning unintelligible words of arousal, he wedged his knee between hers and pushed it up to separate her thighs, then splayed his hand over her bottom and secured her against him. She felt his want, hard and imperative, assertively male. Every feminine inclination in her being yearned to have that potency inside her. When he began undoing the buttons down the front of her nightgown, she said faintly,
The lamp
stays on.
He opened her neckline, slid his hand inside, and lifted her breast clear of her nightgown.
Jesus.
His warm breath drifted over her, as did his fingertips, feather light. He lowered his head and rubbed his lips against her nipple, then swept it with his tongue. She whispered his name and tunneled her fingers into his hair. He hadn't gotten it cut since she had met him. It was longer, thicker than then, and she loved the feel of it sliding between her fingers. When he drew her nipple into his mouth, she closed her fingers, clutching at his hair. He tilted his hips and began moving against her. She arched up to meet the evocative thrusts. Air stirred against her skin as he raised her nightgown up over her hip. He cradled the back of her knee in his palm, squeezed it with strong fingers, then began stroking her inner thigh. His touch was gentle but bold, dictating adjustments in position as he worked his hand up to where she lay open. His exploring caresses brought her into stunning awareness of her own feverish, full achiness of how wet she was. When he pressed a finger into her, she flinched. But reflexively, she clenched, signaling a desire for more. He withdrew his finger, but where he touched her next caused her body to jerk in response. He began drawing fluid circles upon that spot. When at the same time his mouth tugged on her nipple, her body began to tingle throughout. It was wonderful. It terrified her. She gasped, What are you? And then all control spun away from her. Her throat arched, her hips came up off the bed, seeking the cursive design of his strokes. If he stopped, she would die. If he continued, she would die. She ground against his hand in her desire to be engulfed by this tidal wave of sensation, even as she feared being drowned by it. She panicked and cried out,
Stop!
He did so instantly. He pulled his hand from beneath her nightgown and braced himself above her on one arm.
Laurel?
Don't!
Using hands and heels, she madly pushed herself from beneath him, moving all the way up to the brass headboard. She crammed the hem of her nightgown into the V of her thighs, grabbed a pillow and held it against her bared breasts. Her nipples were pinpoints of sensation. Thatcher was looking at her with bewilderment and concern.
What?
She couldn't speak for the currents that continued to ripple through her. Even as they ebbed, her breathing remained choppy.
Did I hurt you?
She shook her head and managed a gruff, No. She pulled down her nightgown to cover her legs.
I'm not like the French girls, that's all.
He frowned.
What?
I know about them. Derby told me. He admitted that he had been with a few women while he was over there. Only because of the horrible things he saw. I couldn't hold it against him, could I?
He opened his mouth to speak, but she cut him off before he could.
He told me the girls over there do things that are unheard of in America, against the law even. Not only prostitutes, regular girls. I'm sure you had your share of them.
He looked down at the floor and ran his hand around the back of his neck.
Laurel.
Of course you did. That's none of my business. Just don't expect me to be like them and do things.
She raised her chin toward the bedroom door.
Please be enough of a gentleman to leave now.
He looked like he wanted to argue, to say more, but he exhaled heavily and turned away from the bed. He picked up his hat and put it on, then pulled on his jacket. He went to the door but didn't open it. Looking back at her, he said,
I didn't finish my story.
I don't want to hear it.
Well, you need to.
It doesn't concern me.
I hope to God not. I really hope to God not, Laurel.
He paused.
See, when we got back to the jail, the sheriff left straight for home. I volunteered to escort Elray inside and lock him up. Deputies were piling out of the other car. Some lit up smokes and jawed about the expedition. Others went inside. I hung back with Elray and seized the opportunity to ask him in private what he'd been lying about.
He'd told you the truth.
But not all of it. I knew he was holding something back about Wally's murder, something that had recently come to light. He hem-hawed around, but finally told me that a tip had come from none other than Gert. According to her, a competing moonshiner had done Wally in.
That's not at all surprising.
I didn't think so either, but I sensed that Elray was still withholding something. I kept pressing him about the identity of this bloodthirsty competitor, and he finally gave up what he knew.
Which was?
It's a woman.
Laurel's breathing was suspended for a full 15 seconds before Thatcher continued.
I doubted him. I told him that either Gert was lying or she'd been misunderstood.
Elray swore he was there when Gert named the culprit to his great-uncle Hiram. Naturally, I encouraged him to give me her name, and I believe he eventually would have, except that somebody shot him through the head from the roof of the bank building.
Laurel exhaled in a burst. Oh my God, Thatcher!
He stared at her for several beats.
He was standing no more than a foot away from me. I saw his eyes go dead before he dropped.
She covered her mouth with a shaking hand.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so am I. He wouldn't have been there if it weren't for me.
He put his hand on the doorknob and addressed it rather than her.
Sheriff Amos predicted that there was going to be a bloody moonshine war. He said he could use an extra deputy and offered me the job. I turned him down, told him it didn't have anything to do with me, that it wasn't my fight, and I wouldn't be taking sides. That's the thing that changed tonight. He reached into his pocket, took out the now familiar badge, and looking back at her, pinned it to his lapel. Irv was standing in the kitchen, holding the shotgun aimed at the door through which Thatcher had to pass on his way out. When he saw Irv, he stopped. The two squared off, and when Irv spotted the badge, his scowl deepened. He said,
Badge or not, I could shoot you for trespassing.
You could, but just so you know, I'm unarmed. To a jury, that might look like murder.
I could murder you for messing with my daughter-in-law.
I'd be dead. Laurel would be left to suffer a scandal.
It's Laurel now, is it?
Yes.
Thatcher walked forward until the barrel of the shotgun was inches from his belly.
It's Laurel. And hear me, plumber. If you and your moonshining get her killed, I'm going to kill you.
He allowed time for the words to sink in, then he stepped around the old man and left through the back door. 44. Norma was seated on a stool at her vanity table, plucking her eyebrows, when Patsy sauntered into the bedroom.
You're not even dressed yet.
Norma yanked out the last wayward hair, dropped the tweezers onto the vanity, and swiveled around.
What's your rush?
I'm not in a rush. The man at the bank is, and he keeps banker's hours.
What is the problem?
Something to do with a signatory card.
He was expecting us at 1 o'clock. It's 30 minutes after. Can't you handle it alone? I don't want to get Arthur up just to traipse in and out of the bank.
5 minutes later, Patsy left the house more noisily than necessary, probably in a spiteful attempt to wake Arthur from his nap, but he slept peacefully in his bassinet. Earlier, Norma had placed it near the open living room window that provided a gentle southern breeze. She was returning to her bedroom when she heard an auto braking out front. Thinking that Patsy must have forgotten something, she muttered,
"Not a moment's peace around here."
But when she looked out the window, her irritation evolved into apprehension. Bernie Croft was climbing out of an unfamiliar automobile. It wasn't his long touring car, but a much smaller roadster. For once, his chauffeur, whom she secretly feared, wasn't with him. She overlapped the sides of her silky, floral-patterned robe and tied the belt tightly around her waist. It was almost back to what it had been before the baby. Her curvy figure was coveted by women and lusted after by men. Arthur had been worth the temporary bloating, but she was glad to have her notable figure restored. As Bernie neared the door, she opened it and, with more bravado than she felt, said,
"This is a surprise."
"A good one, I hope."
"A delightful one."
She stood aside. He came in. This being his first time ever to come here, he took a look around. Like the rest of the house, the main room was shabby overall. The wallpaper was faded. The window curtains sagged unevenly. There were stains on the rug. In these surroundings, Bernie looked all the more immaculate and imposing.
"I'm a mess," she said. "Give me a sec."
"Of course."
Norma rushed into her bedroom and inspected herself from the different angles provided by the tri-panel mirror. Damn it, she didn't look her best. Although it was after lunchtime, she'd spent a lazy morning and hadn't even powdered her nose. There wasn't time to pin up her hair, so she fluffed it around her shoulders. Grabbing a tube of lipstick, she applied a coating, then turned toward the door as Bernie strode in and tossed his hat onto a chair piled with discarded clothing. Embarrassed over the bedroom's messiness, she made a self-conscious gesture of helplessness.
"The baby keeps me so busy, I don't have time to do much else."
Then, around a nervous laugh, she added, "Not that I've ever been much of a housekeeper."
"You weren't expecting company."
"Especially not such important company."
His affectionate smile relaxed her. Gabe wouldn't have been fool enough to tell Bernie that she was in on their secret about Pointer's Gap.
"Would you like something? Maybe some iced tea?"
"Nothing, thank you, except privacy."
He shut the bedroom door with his elbow. She would have preferred that it be left open a crack so she could hear Arthur if he stirred, but Bernie was having to bat away the articles of clothing hanging on the back of the door that had swung outward and swiped his face, so she let it go.
"Did you see Arthur?"
"I took a look," he said, "but you're who I came to see."
Responding to the suggestiveness of his tone, she moved her shoulder enough to make the robe slip off it.
"I hope you don't mind that I didn't consult you on the baby's name. Do you like it?"
"It'll do."
"Well, I couldn't name him after you, could I?"
He laughed. "God, no."
"He has your wide brow. I hope no one notices the resemblance."
"No one will be looking for one," he said. "If they look for resemblances to anyone, it will be Gabe."
"Yes, our marriage coming so soon after his wife's disappearance may raise a few brows, but I've come up with a tragic love story."
She placed the back of her wrist to her forehead and struck a dramatic pose.
"Arthur's father was taken too soon, I'll say, and give a delicate sniff-sniff. He never got to see his son, but he would be pleased to know that his child's stepfather is a prominent physician, a loving man who treats Arthur as his own.
He grinned. You've got it all planned.
I am a planner, but I do like surprises. She leaned back against her vanity table, letting her robe fall open, baring her legs. Appreciating the view, Bernie walked toward her.
You're no pious-looking Madonna, Norma.
She fluttered her eyelashes. Thank you for saying so.
How is motherhood?
Sleep-depriving. But I adore Arthur. He's a good baby. Bernie fingered the silk lapels of her robe, then impatiently pushed them apart.
Are you a good mother?
I think so. I want to be.
I'm sure you are.
He covered her breasts with his wide hands and squeezed.
With these titties, I'm sure you excel. Arthur's a lucky little bastard.
She recoiled. Don't call him that.
That's what he is.
It's an ugly word.
I agree.
He looked up from her breasts into her eyes.
So is whore.
Her lips parted in shock.
And that's what you are, Norma.
I'm not.
The word fits you to a T.
His squeezes had become painful pinches. She pushed his grasping hands away and pulled her robe together. You had better leave. Gabe wouldn't like knowing that...
That I was fucking you on the night he called me in a panic over killing his wife?
He never has to know about us.
Maybe he should.
No. Anyway, that phase of my life is over. I got what I wanted.
A well-to-do husband with a lovely home.
Yes.
Respectability.
Yes.
Gabe hasn't married you yet.
Soon, though.
But the blushing bride-to-be welcomes me, naked except for that cheap, tacky robe and red lipstick.
Before I knew you were going to be so horrid.
You thought we would end our affair on a sweeter note.
Yes.
I hate to disappoint.
He pulled back his fist and slammed it into her face. The pain was so excruciating, she didn't even feel the center mirror of her vanity shattering against her back when she fell into it. He hit her in the face again, this time hard enough to knock her to the floor. She groped for the vanity stool to try and pull herself up and attempt some kind of defense, but he kicked the stool out of her reach. She crawled on all fours in an effort to escape his hammering fists and the vile things he was saying to her and about her. Worse, he didn't shout the insults in outrage. He spoke them in a soft but repugnant parody of sweet nothings. He kicked her in the ribs. Then he stopped and stood over her, breathing heavily. She thought that perhaps that was the end of it. He'd vented his rage. He was through. But then he stamped on her, and the pain was unimaginable. She screamed. He pulled her up by her hair and pushed her face first onto the bed. He held her down with one hand and used the other to shove her robe up above her waist. He clamped the tops of her thighs and forced them apart. She tried to scream again, but the mattress beneath her battered face muffled the sound. She couldn't draw in sufficient air through either her nose or her split and bleeding lips. She feared suffocating. But in a black and distant part of her mind, she wished she would. His thrusts were brutal. His hands held her with bruising strength. His language was obscene, vicious, abasing. It seemed to go on forever. Then, heaving and hot, he collapsed on top of her, leaden, compressing her lungs, making spears of the ribs he'd broken. But he lifted his hand from her head, allowing her to turn it aside and try to suck in air through her mouth, but nothing was functioning right. His sweat had combined with the cloying scent of his cologne, making her gag. She choked on blood. Finally, he pushed off of her. Standing beside the bed, he righted himself. She heard the rustle of his clothing, the jingle of his belt buckle, the clink of his watch fob. The floorboards creaked under his weight as he crossed the room toward the door. It whooshed open, the clothes hanging on the back of it swishing. In a voice that was eerily detached, he said,
If you have the misfortune of surviving, and if you breathe a word of this, I'll tie that brat of yours in a sack and throw him in the Brazos.
He walked out of the bedroom. He left the house. Norma was too benumbed to move. 45. Laurel baked all day. Recollections of what had happened between Thatcher and her last night were persistent distractions, and her feelings about them ranged from delirium to despair. Work helped to keep those troubling thoughts from swamping her, but they lurked at the fringes of her mind, teasing and tormenting. While her last batch of pies was cooling, she delivered Clyde Martin's order to the cafe. By dusk, when the O'Connors showed up, she had pies boxed and ready for them.
"Where's the whiskey?"
Davy asked.
"We're fresh out. There's been some trouble. Our distiller had to shut down and relocate in a hurry. I'm hopeful he'll do a run tonight, but at this point, I just don't know. In the meantime, we're in the pie business exclusively."
The twins took the news with a surprising lack of despondency.
"Don't worry yourself, lovely Laurel," Davy said. "In view of our recent shortfall, we've been courting another supplier to keep us in moonshine should another shortage occur, which it has. Once we're up and running again..."
"Wait, what other supplier? Who?"
"Now, Laurel, you know better than to ask," Mike said. "We can't give you his name any more than we'd give him yours. It's all very discreet."
"Is he reliable?"
"Yes," Davy said, "but reliability is expensive."
"How expensive?"
They told her the terms of the deal they'd negotiated, and they were reasonable. Nevertheless, she was leery.
"I don't like having to buy moonshine in order to sell it."
"A temporary necessity," Mike said.
His brother added, "And a smaller profit is better than none."
"Is his whiskey any good?"
"We thought so," Mike said.
His glazed eyes indicated that he had had more than a sampling, which reassured Laurel not at all. Dividing a stern look between them, she said,
"You're sure of this?"
Davy answered for both.
"We wouldn't let you down, sweetheart."
Reluctantly, she counted out the currency they would need to purchase the moonshine.
"Just this once."
Before they set off, she pleaded with them.
"Please, please be careful. A young man was killed last night right in front of the sheriff's office."
"Oh, we heard about that. Tragic for sure.
But it's rumored that it was a family dispute. Nothing to do with us."
She could have argued that it wasn't any old family's dispute, it was a Johnson family dispute, and that if they discovered that it was her still where their kinsman Tup had been maimed, the clan would be gunning for her. The less the twins knew of that, the better. She also didn't want them knowing that she was consorting with a lawman. Her discussion of Elray's slaying might lead to mention of Thatcher, a subject best avoided. But no sooner had she thought that than Mike said,
"Did you hear about your good Samaritan, Mr. Hutton?"
"What about him?"
"Ah, he was talking to the young man when it happened. A second shot missed Hutton by a hair."
Davy picked up.
"But he took off running to the building where the shots came from. Couldn't be stopped, they said."
Laurel's hands had gone clammy.
"Who said?"
she asked huskily.
"The sheriff's deputies trying to hold him back, because he wasn't even armed. But that didn't stop him sprinting to the bank building. He was mad to catch the shooter. Those there said he never uttered a word, but that the look in his eyes was positively feral."
"He didn't catch him?" she asked.
"No," Mike said. "Lucky for the murdering Johnson."
Laurel put up a disinterested front, but she couldn't wait for the twins to be on their way. After they left, she felt more forlorn than she had since Derby's suicide and Pearl's death. She'd had no control over either of those life-changing events. But rather than surrender to feelings of defeat, she had resolved never to be that defenseless against fate again. With sheer determination, she had persevered, had built a life and livelihood for herself. Now she felt control of that also slipping away. Recent events had played out on their own, without her knowledge or oversight. Irv had been wounded. A man had lost his arm. a boy had lost his life. Ernie and Corinne and the Stills were unaccounted for. Where had her tight grip on control been when all that was happening? And when she was with Thatcher? Last night he'd come to her after what surely had been one of the worst experiences of his life, but his concern had been for her, not for himself. She recalled the sorrow in his eyes when he'd told her about his mentor's death and L. Ray Johnson's murder. She also remembered the determination in his demeanor when he'd pinned on the badge. Some might mistake his reticence for indifference or a steeliness against emotion, but he felt things more deeply than anybody she'd ever met. She'd fought her attraction to him every step of the way, but last night she'd been helpless against it. She'd been overtaken by the look and feel of him, the desperation in his voice when he'd said, "Please don't answer." Unlike anything she'd ever experienced, the groundswell of sexual sensation brought on by his caresses had completely undone her. The control had belonged to him, not to her, and that loss of herself had been terrifying, but also thrilling. If the climb had been that incredible, what would the cresting have felt like? She couldn't help but wonder and regret.
"Laurel?"
Nearly jumping out of her skin, she whipped around to find Irv standing behind her and dressed to go out.
"You were a million miles away, girl. What were you thinking about?"
"Nothing."
"Huh, didn't look like it to me."
He watched her for a moment.
"I threatened to shoot him. If you want me to, I will."
Ignoring that, she patted her pocket to make certain she had her pistol.
"Are you ready?"
Laurel insisted on driving, even though they were taking Irv's truck. He gave in way too easily, leaving Laurel to believe that even though the bullet wound had closed and healed well enough for him to leave his bed, his arm remained infirm. He brought Ernie's map with him, although he claimed to know where his partner had likely relocated their stills.
"He showed me the place once, bragged on it being nearly perfect like our other spot."
"Is it on your property?"
"Barely."
When she shot him a doubtful glance, he added defensively,
"Barely counts."
They drove for half an hour. When they saw a flicker of firelight in the distance, Laurel slowed down.
"They may start shooting before they realize it's us."
"Honk the horn 3 times. That's the signal."
The new location had the natural attributes of the original. Ernie and Corinne had both stills reassembled, and both were cooking. Over cups of coffee, they told Laurel and Irv about the harrowing night they had spent moving everything. Ernie said,
"Soon's we got the trap off that fella's arm and put him in the hole, I ran for my truck, brought it to the site, and started loading everything up. Even with a gimp arm, she did all right," he said, looking over at Corinne.
"I like to have worn myself out," she said. "But in a way, it was good we had to take everything apart and put it back together here. I learned a lot, but I don't want to do it again anytime soon."
"We wasn't sure you'd get the map," Ernie said. "It was her idea to leave it."
Laurel told them about her seeing the convoy from the shack and racing over the hill to beat it.
"Although at the time I didn't know it was lawmen, it could just as well have been rival moonshiners. Imagine my shock to see the place deserted and not knowing what had happened to you."
She finished telling the rest of it.
"I can't explain what inspired me to get the primer. Irv figured out what the drawing meant."
Ernie tossed the dregs of his coffee into the dirt and watched as it was absorbed.
"Was the thief I trapped a Johnson?"
Laurel nodded.
"He and a younger cousin."
"He'd die in the hidey hole?"
"Miraculously, no, but his arm was amputated."
He nodded solemnly.
"Then he probably won't be stealing no more."
"Probably, but that was a big price to pay for a few crates of moonshine."
"Yep, it was, Miss Laurel. But given the chance, he'd have killed us without blinking."
Thatcher had reasoned the same. She said,
"It's believed that was his intention."
"What about the cousin who ran out on him?"
"Shot and killed last night," Laurel said. "They feel for sure by his own kin."
She related the circumstances, but didn't refer to Thatcher by name, only as a deputy who was seeking information about Wally's murder. As though reading her mind, Corinne asked,
"You seen any more of Mr. Hutton?"
Irv harumphed and kept his head down, poking at the logs in the cook fire with a stick. Laurel said,
"He came by one evening to check on Irv's progress."
Quickly changing the subject, she asked Ernie about their renewed production.
"Can you step it up?"
"We brought 6 barrels of mash with us that were close to ready. The rest we had to pour out. Luckily, we had enough supplies to mix up more yesterday and today."
"We've got 2 crates you can take with you," Corinne said with pride. "I got 'em ready myself while Ernie was mixing the mash."
2 crates wouldn't have excited Laurel a few days ago, but now she was glad to know she had them. She didn't tell the others about the O'Connors buying from another moonshiner, knowing that they, particularly Irv, who mistrusted the twins, would disapprove. She disapproved. They discussed more about the operation. Then Laurel expressed her misgivings.
"Tup and Elray Johnson found our stills. How well hidden are you here, Ernie?"
"Pretty good, I reckon, or I wouldn't have moved us here."
He glanced around at the others.
"But about them Johnsons finding us."
"What?" Irv said.
"Just seems unlikely is all," Ernie said.
Without looking directly at anyone, he added,
"Unless they were keeping an eye on the shack."
"Why would they be doing that?"
Laurel asked. He shrugged his bony shoulders.
"If somebody was to have tipped him off."
Laurel's ears began to roar as Thatcher's words came back to her in a surge. Elray swore he was there when Gert told his great-uncle Hiram who the culprit was. The culprit meaning the female moonshiner. Gert knew Laurel was dealing in whiskey. She had been there when Laurel and Lefty had sealed their deal. She'd been livid to learn that Laurel had sheltered Corinne. Narrowed down, that would be in one of 2 dwellings, their house in town or the shack. If it had been discovered that Corinne was living in the shack, if she'd been seen going on foot over the hills, if she'd been followed to the still, Gert would have had the perfect setup for revenge against both Corinne and Laurel. Good God. Everything that had happened in the last 48 hours was a consequence of Laurel's going to the roadhouse that day. Thatcher had said he was afraid they would wind up on opposite sides of a fight. He wasn't afraid of it at all. He already knew that she was moonshining, and last night he'd warned her that, thanks to the vengeful Gert, the Johnsons did too.
"Corinne, things have become dangerous. You have to come back to town with Irv and me," she said. "You're too far from the shack to be going back and forth on foot."
"Ernie and me done talked about it," the girl said. "I'll stay here and help him do runs till we catch up."
"Ernie?" Irv asked. "What do you think of that plan?"
He shifted self-consciously.
"When she ain't blabbing, she's handy."
Laurel came to her feet.
"It doesn't matter what Ernie thinks. It matters what I think."
The 3 of them looked up at her like she'd lost her mind, and very possibly she had. She walked away from them, pressing her fingers against her temples where her pulse was beating fast and hard. There had to be a way out of this, not to save her own skin, but to protect these 3 and the twins. The logical solution to all their problems would be to shut down completely, but then what? She couldn't stop Ernie and Irv from carrying on as they had before her interference. Corinne, having shown an enthusiasm for making corn liquor, would likely join them. The twins were young, daring, and resourceful. They obviously had other contacts in the illegal liquor trade. With their winning personalities, they would prosper. She would bake and sell pies. The dreariest part of that prospect would be that Gert would continue to thrive, turning victims of mistreatment and misfortune into prostitutes for her gain. Laurel slowly came back around to 3 pairs of eyes looking at her expectantly. Corinne would actually be safer out here than she would be in town, where she was much more likely to be seen by someone who would return her to Gert. But this was hardly a Garden of Eden.
"Corinne, are you sure you want to stay here?"
"Oh, I don't mind at all. I'm enjoying being out in the open."
Irv and Laurel looked to Ernie for his opinion.
"She's proved herself to be right smart," he said. "Nimble and quick, too."
"All right," Laurel said, but not without reluctance. For the present, she stays. Please get the crates loaded into the truck. Although Irv couldn't be of much help, he accompanied Ernie. Laurel stayed behind with Corinne. I'll be back the day after tomorrow. She glanced over at the tent. By then, if you've changed your mind about your situation here, you can come back to town with me. You'll have a home with Irv and me. I know what you're asking without coming right out with it. Ernie treats me regular, not like a whore. You were never a whore, Corinne. You were a victim of circumstance. Well, anyway, Ernie has his cranky moments, usually over my jabbering, but he's nice. Even without me asking, he dug a latrine for my private use.
Laurel tried to contain her smile.
That was thoughtful of him.
The men came back for the other crate. As soon as they were out of earshot again, Laurel said,
Corinne, the morning after Irv got shot and you and I were having breakfast, you talked to me about Gert and how upset she'd been with Wally Johnson for the beating he gave you.
Upset? I'll say. She carried on something fierce.
Laurel remembered what Corinne had told her that day, but she wanted to hear it from her again.
What made Gert so angry?
'Cause I looked like roadkill, and she wouldn't be making any money off me, and money is all she cares about.
She was so mad at Wally, her face turned purple. She hollered cuss words, threatened him with a meat cleaver, and ordered him to get his ugly self out of her place.
Laurel patted the girl's shoulder.
Ernie needs help, and you seem content to be here, but I'm worried about your safety.
You got no call to be.
Yes, I do, Corinne, believe me.
Ernie's protective.
I'm sure, but he may not always be around. You need to protect yourself.
I will, Miss Laurel, I promise.
Well, I want to make sure of that.
46. The landlady called Thatcher away from the supper buffet to the telephone in the hall.
Keep it short, she said as she handed him the earpiece. There's others who use it too, you know.
Thinking it might be Trey Hobson at long last, he leaned into the mouthpiece mounted on the wall.
This is Thatcher.
Bill Amos said,
Can you get over to Doc Perkins's office?
Right now?
Right now.
Who's sick?
Just come. Don't say anything to anybody.
The sheriff disconnected. Thatcher hung up, stared at the telephone in puzzlement for several seconds, then, responding to Bill's urgency, ducked back into the dining room to take his hat from the rack. The crabby Mrs. May said,
Are you eating or not?
Not.
He was aware of Chester Landry's interest in his abrupt departure, but he didn't acknowledge the man as he rushed out. He feared the emergency pertained to Daisy Amos. Having to walk several blocks, he was winded by the time he reached the professional building on Main Street, where he'd been told the elderly doctor had a clinic that took up half the third floor. It was past quitting time for anyone else who had office space there, but the main entrance was unlocked. Thatcher went in and climbed the stairs two at a time. A door with the doc's name printed on it opened into a waiting room, where a woman was seated near a small table, smoking a cigarette. She was unkempt. There were blood smears on her dress. Her eyes were red-rimmed, her expression harsh.
Who are you?
He took off his hat.
Thatcher Hutton.
What are you doing here?
Before he could reply, Bill Amos opened a door with examination room stenciled on it.
I called him, he said to the woman,
then hitched his head, indicating for Thatcher to join him in a small room with glass-fronted supply cabinets on two walls. The center was dominated by the examination table.
Through here,
Bill said, as he led Thatcher through yet another room into an operating room. He drew up short when he saw the table on which a female person lay. A white sheet covered her from toes to chin. All that showed was a mass of thick dark hair and her face, which looked like it had had a head-on collision with a locomotive. Wearing a white lab coat, Doc Perkins was washing his hands at an industrial-sized porcelain sink. Thatcher recognized the strong smell of antiseptic from his days in the Army hospital. Bill said,
That's Norma Blanchard.
Stunned, Thatcher remembered the pretty, shapely woman with the saucy walk whom he'd seen going into Gabe Driscoll's house late one night.
She dead?
As of when I called you. I wanted you to see her to get an idea of what we're dealing with here.
Thatcher wanted to object to the plural pronoun. In his mind, he'd taken a stand against the likes of the violent Johnsons, but he hadn't been sworn in as a deputy yet, and he wasn't wearing the badge. However, now wasn't the time to go into all that. Thatcher said,
"Who's the woman outside?"
"Miss Blanchard's sister, Patsy Kemp."
She was no doubt the woman who'd chauffeured Norma to Gabe Driscoll's house, but Thatcher hadn't gotten a good look at her face that night and wouldn't have recognized her.
Bill said, "I asked her to stay so we could talk to her about the assault."
"Assault? This wasn't an accident?"
"No. Mrs. Kemp brought Norma to Dr. Perkins around 4 o'clock. She was barely alive. He evaluated her condition and called me right away. She never regained consciousness."
To the doctor, he said,
"Give him a rundown. No medical jargon, please. Plain talk."
The doctor unhooked the wire stems of his eyeglasses from behind his ears, removed them, and began polishing them with the towel he'd used to dry his hands.
"Her nose is broken. Pulverized, actually. Fractured cheekbone, broken jawbone, 3 loose teeth. A flap of scalp about an inch in diameter had been ripped away. I sewed it back, but that's the least of it."
He replaced his glasses and looked down at the draped figure.
"The back of her torso appears to have been pummeled repeatedly, I suspect with fists. I also tweezed out several shards of mirror glass that had sliced through her garment."
He pointed to a silky dressing gown wadded up in a chair.
"I detected 3 broken ribs. Others may have been cracked. She might have survived in time, and under the care of physicians better trained and skilled at treating the more serious of her injuries."
"What were they?"
"She has a sizable bruise and swelling above her left kidney. It's so precisely placed, it appears the organ was targeted, perhaps by the heel of a shoe. I suspect the blunt force caused internal hemorrhaging. She bled to death."
The doctor's eyes looked apologetic behind the round lenses of his glasses.
"I did what I could, but I'm a country doctor, unqualified to deal with something like this. Perhaps Gabe Driscoll would have been a better choice."
Bill glanced at Thatcher, then turned to the doctor.
"Tell him the rest."
The doctor bowed his head and addressed the floor.
"She was raped, barbarically. Considerable damage was done to tissue."
The men stood silent, looking neither at each other nor at Norma Blanchard's still form. After a moment, the doctor covered her face. In a quiet voice, Bill said,
"Her injuries are of such a sensitive nature, I'd like to keep the details between us, Doc."
"Of course."
"Do you mind if we use your waiting room to talk to Mrs. Kemp?"
"Not at all. I'll stay with Miss Blanchard until the ambulance arrives."
"Ambulance?" Thatcher asked.
"I want the autopsy done in Dallas," Bill said. "They have a lab, forensic specialists."
Thatcher took a last look at the sheet-draped figure, then followed Bill from the surgery and back out into the waiting room. Patsy Kemp hadn't changed her position since Thatcher had come in. Bill pulled a chair over closer to her and motioned for Thatcher to do the same. When they were seated, Bill said,
"I'm awfully sorry this terrible thing has happened, Mrs. Kemp."
She gave him a curt nod.
"This is Thatcher Hutton."
"So he said."
"He's new to my department. We'd like to ask you some questions, gain as much information as we can in an effort to catch the person who assaulted your sister."
She sat stony-faced.
Bill asked softly, "Where's her baby?"
"I dropped him off with a lady I buy fresh eggs from. She has a baby close to Arthur's age. She'll wet nurse him and look after him until I can pick him up."
"Good."
Bill paused, then said,
"You know the extent of what was done to your sister?"
"I found her, remember?"
"Do you know who attacked her?"
"No."
"At any point, was she conscious?"
"Conscious, but out of her head.
Did she say?
Did you see her mouth? She couldn't talk.
Bill eased away from her, as though sensing, as Thatcher did, that pressuring her wasn't the tack to take.
Tell us what happened today.
Do we have to do this now?
Do you want us to catch the man responsible?
Bill won the stare off. She took a deep breath.
Today started out like any other. I did chores while Norma tended to Arthur.
You told me earlier that the assault took place while you were away from the house.
She told them about receiving a telephone call from First State Bank.
I don't remember the man's name. He asked me to come in and take care of a matter, something I needed to sign. Arthur was down for a nap. Norma was primping. It was easier to go without her than to wait for her to get ready. She was very particular about her appearance.
She glanced toward the examination room. Her eyes turned watery.
Norma wouldn't have wanted to live looking like that. Jesus God.
She took a cigarette from her pack. When she had difficulty striking the match, Thatcher struck it for her and held it to the tip of the cigarette. She gave him a nod of thanks. The men allowed her time to compose herself and take a few puffs before Bill asked,
What time did you leave the house?
1:30. I was trying to beat it to the bank before it closed, but when I got there, nobody knew anything about a phone call. There wasn't a problem with my account. I didn't know what to make of the mix-up, but rather than waste a trip to town, I stopped in Logan's for some groceries.
Her voice trembled.
I'll never forgive myself for not going straight home.
Thatcher noticed that her hand was shaking when she flicked an ash into the ashtray she was holding on her knee.
I could hear Arthur screaming the minute I pulled up to the house. Norma wouldn't let him whimper without picking him up, so I knew something was wrong. I ran into the house. Arthur was still in his bassinet, where he'd been when I'd left. He was wet and hungry, but otherwise okay.
Norma.
She choked up and had to force the words out.
She was face down on her bed. She wasn't moving. There was blood. I would have thought she was dead, except that she was making sounds like, I don't know, a wounded animal.
She took another drag off her cigarette.
I'm not sure she knew it was me who was handling her. She flailed her arms, trying to fight me off. I'd like to have never gotten her into the car.
No sign of who had been there?
Don't you think I would have told you by now?
Was anything missing that you noticed?
I didn't take the time to look, Sheriff.
I ask only because if the house had been ransacked, it could have been a vagrant.
The house hadn't been ransacked.
Your sister's bedroom?
It was a mess, but it always is. The vanity stool was overturned, the mirror had been shattered, glass was everywhere.
When you left for your errand, had you locked the front door?
Yes.
Was it locked when you returned?
She had to think for a second, then said,
No.
Was the lock damaged?
I think I would have noticed if it had been broken.
Then it's possible that Miss Blanchard knew her attacker and let him into the house.
She bent her head down and massaged her forehead. Bill cleared his throat.
Where's Mr. Kemp?
His name is Dennis. He's in Colorado.
What's he do there?
Sets dynamite. He blasts through mountains for railroad and highway construction.
She raised her head and gave Bill a baleful look.
Is this important?
When did you last hear from him?
Barking up that tree will be a waste of your time. Every 2 months I go to see him. He hasn't come home since Norma moved in with us.
They didn't get along?
Couldn't stand each other. She called him a bore. He called her silly and conceited. In a mumble, she added, among other things.
If there's so much animosity between them, why did she come to live with you?
She hesitated, looking resentful of the question. Finally, she said,
Because the man she had been living with in Austin kicked her out for cheating on him. She had no money, no job, nowhere else to go.
Bill asked her to write down the name of the company her husband worked for. She did. The sheriff tucked it into his breast pocket.
What about the father of her son?
She smoked, saying nothing. Bill prompted,
Had Norma been asking him for money? Demanding that he marry her, something like that?
Having smoked her cigarette down, she ground it out.
I wouldn't know, Sheriff Amos, because I don't know who Arthur's father is.
She caught the skeptical look Thatcher and Bill exchanged.
You don't believe that? It's true. Swear to God I don't know.
She turned to Thatcher.
You're young and good-looking. Were you acquainted with my sister?
No, ma'am, but I saw her once.
Did your eyes pop out of your head?
He gave a shy smile, and she snuffled.
Norma had that effect on men.
Turning back to the sheriff, her momentary mirth disappeared.
She used her looks to her advantage. She had a lot of men. But to be dragging her name through the dirt while her body is still warm just doesn't sit right with me.
Before Bill could respond, Thatcher said,
It isn't right, but neither is a brutal, fatal assault. What Sheriff Amos is trying to do is find out who did it. The more information you give him, the better chance he has of catching the man and seeing him punished.
Patsy's chest caved in a little. Her hostility cooled. As she thought over what Thatcher had said, she picked at the loose stitching on the handbag in her lap.
Norma had been carrying on an affair with Dr. Gabe Driscoll.
She looked at Bill and Thatcher in turn. He wondered if she noted that neither was surprised to hear this. Bill asked,
For how long?
Close to a year.
Where did they rendezvous?
He always came to the house, or did. He hasn't been there since the night his wife disappeared. Norma wasn't happy about not seeing him.
Up until Mrs. Driscoll's disappearance, how often did they meet?
2 or 3 times a week. He would come by while he was out making rural calls. But he isn't Arthur's father. Norma was already pregnant when she met him. She only passed the baby off as his to reel him in. She set her sights and went after him.
Watching her closely, Bill tugged at the corner of his mustache.
Did they conspire to get rid of Mrs. Driscoll?
I don't think Norma had anything to do with it.
Mrs. Kemp.
I'll tell you why, she said, cutting Bill off. Norma didn't consider Gabe's missus competition. She had convinced herself that Gabe would ultimately choose her and Arthur over that fat German cow, as she called her. She had big plans for Gabe to move her and Arthur into that large, pretty house. As his wife, she would become a society maven. I told her she was delusional, but I also saw how besotted Gabe was with her.
She shrugged.
Maybe he gave in to her impatience.
Gabe claims to have been at your house twice on the day his wife went missing, once in the afternoon, once late that night.
He was, but not to help with Arthur's breech birth, because Arthur was already a month old. Gabe came that afternoon. He held the baby for half an hour and spent another 30 minutes in the bedroom with Norma. They were lovey-dovey. She begged him to stay longer and was pouty when he left. When he came back that night, it was a different story. He was frantic. I mean, berserk, batshit crazy. I had to deal with him myself because Norma was out.
Out where?
Thatcher could tell she was reluctant to answer, but finally she did.
There was someone else, before Gabe, and the whole time she was with him.
The baby's father?
That would be my guess, but I don't know. It was a very secretive affair. She always went to him. She was with him that evening of Mrs. Driscoll's disappearance. When she got back home, Gabe was there, but he was too distraught even to ask where she'd been.
What time did she get home?
Midnight or better. Honestly, I believe Gabe is rather thick. She smelled of sex. He's a doctor, right?
She snorted with derision.
Arthur was a hefty newborn. Any fool could see he was too big to be 6 weeks early, as Norma claimed. But Gabe never raised a question about his size or seemed to doubt that he was the father. In my opinion, he's a loser.
Bill said, But you covered his lie about the breech birth.
I did, yes. Norma insisted that we back him up, for Arthur's sake, she said.
Did Gabe kill his wife, Mrs. Kemp?
I swear to you, I don't know.
Did you ever question Norma about the convenient timing of Mrs. Driscoll's disappearance?
No,
she replied in her wheezy smoker's voice.
I didn't want to know the answer.
Bill sighed.
When two people share a secret like that, it tends to erode the relationship, whether it's between siblings, husband and wife, illicit lovers. If it turns out that Gabe Driscoll assaulted your sister today...
Then all bets are off. I'll dance naked at his hanging. But...
She shook another cigarette from the pack. Thatcher lit it for her. Bill said,
You were about to say, Mrs. Kemp?
I'm not sure Gabe has it in him to do that. I told you she was pouty when he left that afternoon. It was because he wouldn't make love to her. Our walls are thin. I could hear her trying to seduce him. He refused, saying it was too soon after the baby for them to have sex. So the way she was violated today just doesn't seem like him. Murder, maybe, but not that.
Not even if he'd found out the baby isn't his? Bill asked. Maybe he realized that he'd been duped, suckered into killing his wife and his own unborn child for another man's. That could have motivated him to fly into a blind rage.
She said,
Then they ought to hang the bastard twice.
15 minutes later, the ambulance from Dallas arrived. Bill directed it to the back of the building where Norma Blanchard's body was loaded. Patsy was going to follow in her car. She told Bill that her husband had family in Dallas and that she had arranged to stay with them until her sister's body could be released for burial.
Please remember that you're a material witness in two crimes, Bill said. I'll need to reach you.
I understand.
She gave him her relative's telephone number and address. As they watched her departure, Bill said to Thatcher,
She could also face charges of obstruction if Mila Driscoll suffered the fate I suspect, but I didn't want to tell her that.
They returned to the doctor's office so Dr. Perkins could sign off on departmental paperwork. Thatcher remained in the waiting room. He noticed that Patsy had left her last cigarette smoking in the ashtray. He went over and stubbed it out. Then he and Bill left the office together and started downstairs. Bill slipped a small stoppered bottle into the pocket of his jacket, and when he saw that Thatcher noticed, he said,
For Daisy.
Is she all right?
For the past few days, she's had a stomach ache. Doc said this would settle it.
Thinking of the picture gallery in the Amos's foyer, Thatcher said,
I wonder if Mrs. Kemp has a picture of Norma.
Lots. I saw them in the house when I went to interview them.
That's good. When the boy gets older, he'll want to know what his mother looked like.
Bill gave him an inquiring look, but he pretended not to see it and returned to the topic of the attack on Norma Blanchard.
I've been thinking about something.
Don't hold back.
A man in a blind rage would have killed her outright. Whoever attacked that woman wanted to punish her to death. There's a difference.
Bill took that in, then gave him a wry smile.
Don't talk yourself out of that badge, Thatcher. You were born for this.
He continued on his way down the stairs. Thatcher followed. As they exited the building, Bill cursed under his breath. Bernie Croft was between them and the sheriff's car, waiting for his dog to finish peeing against a utility pole. 47.
Hello, Bill. Hutton.
Bernie, Bill said.
Thatcher didn't believe that the mayor's being here at this precise time was coincidental with his dog's bladder. He was right. When the dog lowered his head and wandered off to sniff at a patch of weeds growing against the side of the building, Croft strolled along the boardwalk to join them. He looked Thatcher over.
I heard you actively participated in the raid on lefties.
Who'd you hear that from?
A mutual acquaintance of ours.
Thatcher figured he referred to Chester Landry, but didn't remark on it. Croft turned to Bill.
This young man is practically your shadow these days. Thatcher is no one's shadow, Bernie, but if I can twist his arm, I'm going to sign him on as a deputy.
That will raise eyebrows.
It certainly raised yours. Now, if you'll excuse us.
I saw the arrival of an ambulance from my office window.
He looked across the street toward the second-story windows on the facade of City Hall. Bill had told Thatcher that those office windows overlooking Main were to Bernie what the Pope's balcony was to His Eminence. He was saying,
"If I read the insignia correctly, the ambulance came from Dallas. Who was it for?"
"Doctor patient privilege, Bernie," Bill said. "You know I can't divulge the..."
"Was it someone I know? Why was he shuttled off in secrecy behind the building? Was it the Johnson boy? What was his name again?"
"Elray,"
Thatcher said. Croft turned to him.
"Elray, yes. I heard you tried to chase down his assassin. In fact, you seem to be Johnny on the spot since you came to Foley. One can find you anywhere there's disorder."
Thatcher said,
"That seems to make you nervous. I wonder how come."
Croft puffed up like an adder, but he faced Bill again.
"You had just as well tell me who was in that ambulance. I'll wring it out of Dr. Perkins anyway. Save me the climb upstairs."
Bill relented.
"A local woman was assaulted."
Without going into detail, he told Croft what had happened.
"Jesus Christ," he said. "Who was she?"
"I'm keeping it quiet, Bernie, out of respect for the lady and her family's privacy."
"Very sensitive of you, Bill. But other ladies should be made aware that there's a rapist in our midst, don't you think?"
He gave Thatcher a significant look. Thatcher adjusted his stance to a more confrontational one.
"Why don't you just come out and say it, Croft?"
"Say what?"
"Accuse me of preying on women."
"I already did."
"And it didn't stick."
"Gentlemen," Bill said quietly, "let's not draw an audience, please."
The only audience they'd drawn that Thatcher could see was Hennessy, Croft's so-called chauffeur. Cap pulled low, he was leaning against the side of the mayor's car parked across the street, his posture a little too indolent to be genuine, his entire aspect one of menace. Thatcher hadn't made out like he'd noticed him lurking there, but he was well aware. Croft was adding to his list of complaints against the sheriff.
"I just don't understand you. It's obvious to everyone except you, even to men in your department, that your judgment has become clouded of late. Mine hasn't. I'm responsible for the welfare of this town's citizenry, particularly those who can't defend themselves, our children, our female population."
"Oh, for God's sake, Bernie," Bill snapped. "Save the speech." "The victim's name was Norma Blanchard."
The mayor reacted with a start.
"Obviously you knew her," Bill said.
"Not personally, but I knew of her. The pretty sister, correct?"
"She was pretty before today."
"Where was she attacked?"
"In her home."
Again, he